If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
You know, as Donald Rumsfeld once said, and I don't think you can go wrong if throughout your day you try and quote Donald Rumsfeld at least once a day.
Lord have mercy.
As Donald Rumsfeld once said, it's the unknown. It's the, which one is it? You got the known knowns, the known unknowns, but the ones that'll bite you are the known unknowns, or was it the unknown knowns? My point being that there are things as a young couple now that are going to be knowable in your future, but you don't know what they are today. And I'm telling you right now, one of them is, will we be an air conditioner family or a not air conditioner family? Maybe you both have your own apartments. Maybe it doesn't seem to be a big deal. I'm telling you, this is something that is going to affect your life for the rest of your life. I'm not saying a make or break proposition. It's just something to be aware of.
It's not a deal breaker, but you have to negotiate that out before you get married. Right.
So you love her, you love him, she loves you. It's all good. But this part ain't, because one of you is going to be living in a climate half of your life indoors with somebody who's opposite of you. And that's an unknown known, or a known unknown. It's one of those. And I don't know what other list I could warn you about right now. Warn is the wrong word. But just make you aware of something that is going to come up in your life. Maybe I'm thinking along these lines because my wife and I are living in a space about the size of a meat locker lately with two dogs, neither of whom are, what's the word, normal. So we're sort of feeling each other more than we normally do. And these are some of the things. These are some of the things. Does it bother you, say, if the bathroom counter has a lot of stuff on it? You don't know. All you know is, hey, I like you. You like me. This is awesome. Let's go get a beer. And that's your life right now. But at some point, the disposition of the bathroom counter, you're going to realize is something about which you're now going to live the rest of your life. Again, not a deal breaker. Something just to anticipate down the road. Somebody should almost make a list. Elif, make a list. And the list would include things that you can't see from here, but they're there. I guess that would be the unknown knowns.
And some I don't of know those things, though, you don't realize how important they are to you, or if they just get up your crawl until you're actually married living together, and it, you know, takes a few years.
Right. Because it's so true, Kim. I mean, I think there's plenty of young people who are today living together, married or planning on it or whatever, but they don't get the real estate issue around the bathroom counter. I'm not even saying that's a big issue for us, but I...
Do you share with Brenda now? Is that a new thing?
Well, we are sharing the bathroom counter space.
Have you done that in the past?
Not like we're doing now.
Okay. And how many years have you been married?
We got married when I was 23.
Okay. I'm seeing a partition being built in your future.
Definitely double sinks or split sinks, yeah. Yeah. So it's just something to think about. And, you know, and you're right, though. While you may be living around these issues now, we would also advise you that it someday they may become a bigger deal. That's all I'm saying. I'm just trying to help. That's how I roll.
Wouldn't that fall under the umbrella of cleanliness or neatness?
Yeah, I guess so. Although, you know, I was looking at it and I thought that I had neatly stacked all of the bathroom supplies on the corner of the bathroom sink. Whereas I walked in yesterday and the place looked great. Brenda had really done a nice job cleaning up and fixing up the place. But I noticed that everything was off the bathroom counter. And I thought, okay, I didn't realize that she felt differently about this issue than I do. This is her definition of I've cleaned the bathroom. My definition is let's stack all the things neatly in the corner on top of the bathroom counter. Just different definitions.
It's all about how you organize your personal space. And when someone else is in your personal space,
there you are.
Not so good.
There you are. It's 1:14. Okay, let's do this now. I wanted to talk, I said at the about 15 minutes ago, that I wanted to just visit briefly on the end of yesterday's show. Steve Greenberg in the Chicago Sun-Times today has a piece that begins this way. He's writing about Addison Russell, and he begins, one in three women has been a victim of some form of physical violence by an intimate partner in her lifetime. Isn't that stunning? One in three. Maybe not to you. One in three. Sorry if that's unfair to Addison Russell, he writes, the young Cubs star who was accused on social media Wednesday of having hit his wife. Russell says that that statement is false and hurtful. But it has become an issue of increasing significance, writes Greenberg, in the world of sports, that it still isn't openly discussed enough. I thought it was also interesting that when they turn to, you know, after the game, the locker room's open, the reporters come in, how'd we do? We didn't win the game. All right, now what else do you guys want to talk about? And the reporters wanted to ask about the Addison Russell situation. You knew how this was going to go. They'd say, what's your reaction to the Addison Russell news? And they would all say, well, I'm just here to play baseball. We support our teammate, but these allegations are troubling, and so we'll let the process play out. That's what Cubs management said. That's what Cubs players said. But one thing that jumped out at me is how many of the players said, I don't know anything about his personal life. We don't see him or talk to him outside of the team, outside of the locker room, outside of the field. We don't know about him. And some of them said as much as we don't want to know either. Not about Russell per se, but about one another. We all get together as a team, but then we sort of segregate that from our family lives. Chris Bryant said, I try to be the most boring person in the world. I don't want to know about these guys outside. He doesn't socialize with them. He doesn't party with them. But he also said he doesn't even want to know. And to varying degrees, that's what a lot of them said. You know, we're all teammates here, and what happens behind, you know, outside of the baseball arena is something that we try and isolate ourselves from.
See, I find that interesting because when, you know, like we work as a team here in the newsroom and we know everything about everybody's families and our kids, and I'm surprised they don't share that. They travel together. They're, you know, it's interesting.
And if, you know, now, and you see, I could see why the guys do, but I could also see why they don't want to know about each other's lives. But you'd like to think that there would be an environment where somebody is struggling personally with a substance, with alcohol, with women, with whatever the things that plague people's lives. And it would be something they could share with their teammates, and their teammates would help them. I'm not asking these guys to do anything extraordinary. At the end of the day, we want them to be good baseball players. I mean, shoot, we signed Chapman last year to win the World Series, so I get it. But this team seems so close, so mature, so friendly. And it's sort of too bad to see that they really don't know much about each other personally, at least not in Addison Russell's case. Okay, so yesterday we were talking about the fact that this had been outed in social media. And I wondered with Mark Carman if that was a good idea. Carm didn't seem to love the idea that this would be breaking on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. A woman named, was it Mary or Carol? Mary called in. This is part of that conversation.
I am a social worker, and I work for a domestic violence shelter. And when you were discussing the social media aspect of, you know, the abuse issue, and I agree with you that if it's not a proven issue, it shouldn't, you know, be put out there according to reputation and that. But I do disagree that too much of domestic violence is not talked about, and it is hidden, and that actually is a harm for the families and the victims of domestic violence. So when you're discussing not getting it out there, that's just disturbing to me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what did you say your relationship with this topic is? You're a social worker?
I'm a social worker, and I work at a domestic violence shelter.
Well, so just very specifically about this, I really appreciate your call, Mary, but so say a woman has been abused or is being abused by her boyfriend or her husband. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows about that. And in this case, it's a high-profile person. Do you suggest
Correct.
That they tweet that out or put that on Facebook and say, I'm not going to put up with your abuse anymore, that sort of thing?
I believe that it is important that it reaches people that are being abused to know that, yes, I won't take a victim stance. Yes, I will stand up for myself. I will talk about it. I won't keep it as hidden, which many times the face of someone that abuses appears to be in public, very different than in private.
Well, you know,
so
my point.
It is important.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. My point is that if you've got a case, if you're being abused, and if you literally have a case against the guy or want to make a legal case against this guy, mm-hmm. then get yourself an attorney or a public defender. Get the best help you can get. Fighting it out in the social, on a social platform, to me, is more making you feel good, but isn't going to make your case any better. And I wonder if it doesn't actually complicate your life a little, you know?
Well, you see, where I disagree with that is it needs to be talked about. It people need to know that, yes, maybe this is a famous case and this could get more airtime for other people that are going through it, that are afraid to speak up, that are afraid to talk about it.
I'm not sure what the motivation was. If that was it, okay, I'm going to say I'm a champion of women fighting back or empowering themselves, or I'm just ticked and I want people to know. But I wonder what your reaction to that is. My number is 312-981-7200. What advice do you have for the 18 to 24-year-old woman? I'm just looking at the Greenberg piece again in the Sun-Times today, and he talks about women from the ages of 18 to 24 most vulnerable, but maybe you're 54. What advice do you have to them? To go public with it? To shame the guy? To out the guy? To punish the guy that way? Or to try and plot your escape more quietly? I'm interested in your thought about that. What do you say about using social media like this? 312-981-7200. This is John. You're listening to GN. John Williams here. Kathy, thanks for calling. You're on WGN. Hi, how are you?
Hi there. I first wanted to say the last caller, the social worker, would be much more up on the psychological reasons that people stay, much more than I would be, why women don't, as you said, let it be known, get out, whatever. But I can tell you what happened. The petition I had for several years was fixed up by another person in her beauty shop with that person's brother-in-law. And she knew that he already had a restraining order against him from his last relationship. But this girl that I knew, you know, became involved with him anyway. And about 4 years ago, I see her picture on the television that she's missing. And I said, what could have happened to her? Well, what happened to her is, the last time I saw her, she had a very pretty necklace that he had given her, and I said, oh, looks like he's a keeper, right? And she goes, I don't know, he has anger management problems. He killed her. Hello?
No, I'm listening. What a shame.
Yeah, he killed her, and a hunter found her in the woods in Indiana. The court, it hasn't gone to trial yet. He's been in jail the last 4 years. But then the other people in the shop said she would not leave. They knew.
Yeah.
She must have told them, you know, but she wouldn't leave. And I've heard that before. One quote I heard was, a woman takes it like 3 times before she leaves. But some people just keep going on. And that's the one thing I know. The second thing I know is my grandson's wife was in an abusive relationship. And she said when the cops were called, police officers were called, one of the women police officers took her outside and said, if you keep doing this, taking him back, he will kill you.
Yeah. That's a whole nother thing. Boy, that's sad. And boy, that's confounding. It's hard to understand. So maybe that's the motivation, though, by the friend to say, okay, I see this happening and I see how difficult it is for you to get out. Guess what? I'm going to intervene on social media. I'll tell the whole damn story and blow the thing up if you won't.
Well, I would agree with that. I would agree with that because she'd probably still be alive if that had happened.
Sorry to hear your story, Kathy. I appreciate your phone call.
Thanks so much.
Man,
bye-bye.
Have a good day. Yeah, yeah, yeah. John, I'm a domestic abuse survivor. When you hide it, the abuser has more control. But if you let it out, you need a safe place. Putting on social media is risky. Yeah. John, mental and emotional health issues are paramount in this topic. John, plot an escape. First rule to make sure you and your kids are safe. Look at turningpoint.org from Woodstock. John, the crime of society in this is guys are told to deal with it. Females are told to let it out. And this one says, John, women are at the low end of accusation for domestic violence. Screaming, hitting, throwing things and tantrums is part of domestic violence. Playing it like it doesn't exist has ruined our society as we've known it. Not sure what all of that means, but those are some of our texts. It's 128. Still to come, Trey Radel has written the book, The True Story. It's called Democracy. Looks like democracy, only it's crazy. Democrazy. True story of weird politics, money madness, and finger food. He's the former congressman. He was a Tea Party darling. He served one term in Congress, and his reason for losing his seat are infamous. I'll let him describe it. But imagine if you or I were popular enough, rich or famous enough, but not seasoned enough as politicians that we became members of Congress. That happens. It happened to members of the Tea Party. It kind of happened in the White House. And so there you are walking around the halls going, well, now what do I do? This is Trey Radell. And he tells the story about what it's like in Congress from a very freshman point of view. Like, okay, then we do what? Then we go where? So then how does a bill become a law? And he and his staff were looking for one potential piece of legislation as a freshman for him to put his name on. Because you don't have any weight. Nobody knows you. And so they decide that as a congressman from Florida, they were looking at the agriculture bill. And they found that a lot of money is spent subsidizing sheep shearing. And he says, sheep shearing? Why would I care about that? They said, exactly. Nobody in Florida cares about sheep shearing. But you, as a fiscal conservative, one of the Tea Parties coming in to change Congress, you could call this thing out. What a ridiculous expenditure of $50 million. So he said, okay, I'm in. And he sponsored the sheep shearing bill. And what happened to that sort of led to his undoing. That's a very funny, very true, very current story. And he'll join us in a little bit. 137 on WGN. This is John Williams. In our studio is Trey Radell. His book is Democrazy. Or do you say Democrazy?
No, you said it perfect. And you're the first person in any broadcasting to ever say Democrazy. You got it.
Because it's like democracy, but we're crazy here. It's Democrazy. It's a true story of weird politics, money, madness, and finger food. By the way, my producer, Olive, said, John, don't forget to mention the fact that you're interviewing President Roosevelt on stage in August. Tickets will go on sale next week. The show will be at the College of DuPage. Once again, the same guy that does Teddy Roosevelt is the guy that does our Thomas Jefferson. He and I, once or twice a year, do a stage show where I talk to them as themselves on stage. You get a chance to ask questions, too. In TR's case, we'll talk about his safaris, charging up San Juan Hill, speak softly, carry a big stick, you name it. The whole Teddy Roosevelt story, our most fascinating president, maybe our most literate and our swashbucklingest president. But we'll also let you ask him questions about immigration policy or impeachment proceedings or Jim Comey. I mean, it's current stuff and it's past stuff through the eyes of the 26th president. You want to get tickets to that? Yes, you do. And they go on sale next week. Well, we'll tell you mid next week. But circle this now, August 12th show. Trey, welcome to WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm so happy to be back in Chicago where I lived for so many years. I can't thank you enough for the opportunity.
Well, now, how many years were you here? You were a student at Loyola. You did some improv classes at Second City.
I did. Took some improv classes there. Studied at Loyola. I was there from 94 to 2000. So the late 90s. And
94 to 2000. Yeah. I did not know that Loyola was a six-year program. Is that it?
That was my program. That was my deal. Yeah. I did the five-year program and then and lived and worked here in media for about a year where I started my media career before I went on to be a...
Where did you start here?
I was at WBBM. I fetched coffee for Lester Holt.
Nice.
Years ago.
Seriously.
David Curley was another gentleman who was very gracious to me, a bit of a mentor for me. And I also did some per diem work over at the Fox affiliate where, and this is hilarious, this is back in the late 90s. People obviously, even then, even though we're old, we were using computers in the late 90s. One day I walk into that newsroom and I hear, ding, ding. I look over, Walter Jacobson still using a typewriter. I'm like, that's awesome.
Walter Jacobson now does commentaries for us here.
Oh, really?
This is the biggest...
I did not know that.
I haven't told him this, but Walter Jacobson, the legendary commentary writer for Channel 2 and legendary newsman, he is one of the city's great assets.
Yes.
And he still does a weekly commentary we run in the mornings here.
Oh, wow.
So I just came back to WGN Radio recently, and I was like, oh, my God, I think that was Walter Jacobson just walked by.
Wow.
And he's carrying a WGN mug. And as the mug goes by, I look and I go, that's my autograph on the mug. So I'm like, he's walking around with my signature on his mug. I have to call my parents.
Nice.
And I guess this is what happened. I gave that mug as a gift to somebody and signed it. It eventually it found its way to the collection of coffee mugs here. He has adopted it as his own.
That's hilarious.
And so I'm just kind of living with that every single day. That's a beautiful thing. You then eventually found yourself in Florida. You worked in radio and TV there. You got elected to Congress. What year?
2012 was the campaign, sworn in 13. And some idiotic decisions were around the corner.
Let's just jump to that because I want to talk about less about the end of the book and more about the middle of the book. What were the idiotic things that happened? What led to your demise as a member of Congress?
Sure. So I was sworn in, and look, while I have a self-deprecating humor, and in the book, Into My Crazy, I'm very humorous, poke fun at a lot of stuff, the politics, Democrats, Republicans, you name it. But it was a dark time in life. I got there, and I was drinking really heavily, and I was making very bad decisions. And occasionally, I would partake in extracurricular drugs. Cocaine was my thing. After I would drink too much, and I was out late night off of the Hill, and I didn't have to worry about, you know, talking about things like debt-to-GDP ratio with boring Republicans, I made some very bad decisions. I got busted, and I eventually resigned at in 14.
First member of Congress to be arrested while serving for buying cocaine.
Yeah, there you go. Famous or infamous.
Well, that's your words. So then, and then John Boehner, and then you thought, well, that's okay. I'll come clean. I'll tell my story. Maybe I'll even get sympathy and I'll run again. And Boehner pulls you aside and says, oh, no, you're done.
Yeah. I mean, when you go through a dark time like this, I had every thought run through my head of just get out. I mean, I had some very dark thoughts, just to be very frank. And then you start thinking about survival, political survival, career survival. And I'm very open about that. I don't think a lot of people will talk about all the thoughts that they have when they get through something like this, but I do. I try and lay it out how I was so insane at that time. I had mapped out an entire plan of reelection. And then people who I thoroughly respected, like Speaker John Boehner, would eventually had a talk with me. And he said, stick around. You can serve out your term, but you should decide, you should publicly announce that you're not going to run for office again. And I broke his heart. I was very close with Speaker Boehner. He's a good man. We shared a commonality, which is I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah.
Yep. We shared that, went to rival high schools in Cincinnati before I ended up moving here to Chicago. And it hurt. It hurt to break his heart and so many others that were very good to me.
Broke his heart because of the charges against you.
Yeah, that. We were very close.
Did you finish the term?
No, I ended up resigning. So as I go in the book and describe, again, it gets a little humorous because it's so insane the way that the process shakes out. But I ended up resigning because the ethics committee eventually came after me and they have subpoena power. They can drag all of my staff. And these are close friends of mine. They became family at that point. And they had a whole list of questions that were as ridiculous as, name every illicit substance that you've ever used in your life and the people you've done that with. So high school, of course, I smoked a little marijuana. College here in Chicago, believe it or not, there's marijuana here in Chicago. Did that too. And I'm just thinking of my now 40-year-old friends with children being named in some sort of public document. With
really,
the
they wanted you to out all of these people?
They wanted me to just... It was, but let's get to the truth here, though. The ethics committee had no interest in my answers. They just wanted me out. And I got that. At that time, I was getting death threats. My family was a mess. I was a mess physically and mentally. And eventually, it was time to go.
How did your wife take all of this?
My wife is a rock. She's amazing. It was very difficult. It was very difficult on our relationship. You know, the trust issues that I just destroyed.
But being in Congress,
we're still together, though.
Being in Congress is very difficult for you, too. I mean, that's another thing that as a freshman congressman, you and... Who was it? It wasn't your chief of staff. Who was the young man who turned to you on the House floor one day in tears and said, I can't do this anymore. I have to leave because I can't serve you anymore. He said, I'll give you some time to find my replacement. I forget his name now, but he said, this is just too much work. And the both of you shared a tear.
That was my first chief of staff.
Yeah.
And he was also based in Southwest Florida, the area that I represented, worked, lived for so long. And he couldn't do it. You end up wherever you're at in the country is you fly into D.C. on either a Monday or Tuesday and you go till a Thursday or Friday. So for me and my decisions, I'm away from my family. I'm away from my very young son. I'd just gotten out of an insane campaign that was brutal. Pressure, pressure, pressure. This is not to use this as excuses, but everything just kind of built up. And my Tuesdays and Wednesdays started becoming like Fridays and Saturdays. I would work from 6 in the morning until 6 at night like a madman. And then I was just as crazy as at night. And the lifestyle caught up with me.
You talked about how there'd be a reception here and a reception there. You could eat steaks now.
Martinis here, martinis there. I mean, it is. There is a swanky part of D.C. that people despise and hate, and it exists. And what I try and do in DeMont Crazy is not really get judgy about it of like, well, you know, this is so bad. People are out swilling martinis and lobbyists are buying dinner. What I try and do is give you just a real look at what, here's what happens. I'm not there to pass judgment. This is what it is. And so whether it's the steak dinners, the martinis, the drinking, it's all there. I laid out in the book, and because I'm never going to run for office again, I can do it and not have to be tied to any sort of partisan hack talking points or anything like that.
What surprised you as a freshman?
The absolute illogical disdain among Democrats and Republicans for each other. It, in some ways, is like high school cliques. Not only, though, not just Democrats and Republicans, the individual parties have sub-cliques, too. It's like goths and jocks in high school. You know, are you with Nine Inch Nails or Pearl Jam, bro? Like, it's a little ridiculous the way that they have it.
Well, especially for you, and you must have not had hardly any constituency because you're a Republican who's got headphones on. You take public transportation. It's an embarrassment to the party. You're way too young. And then you are making appointments to meet people on the other side of the aisle from your home state. What happened when you reached out to Democrats in Florida?
Sure. One of the first things I did that January, I get sworn in and I tell my chief of staff, I want appointments with every single Democrat. Okay, I'm a Republican. I know I'm going to meet them and spend plenty of time with them. I want to meet Democrats and I want to meet them face to face and say, I'm not here to talk smack about you. I'm not here to yell at you. I want to find areas of common ground. So making an appointment with a Democrat was like ISIS trying to set up an appointment with the Pope.
Yeah. You know, like, well, but you said the staffs were like, what?
Yeah,
why?
Well, why does this guy want to meet? But when I ended up meeting and reaching out to even people that are despised by Republicans, look, I'm half joking about this, but people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I still today have a fantastic relationship with Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Well, this is when she was still
in the good graces of
the Democratic Party. Yeah. But fair enough. But I mean, but my point is, she's at the height of her power.
Yep. Just ahead of the DNC.
You're a freshman Republican. She takes your meeting. I'm surprised that that's a concession. Like, of course she should take your meeting. You guys should be meeting across the aisle. So what's meeting her like under those circumstances?
You know, we sat down, and I remember it like yesterday. We were on the House floor. We sat down at some seats, and she said something that stuck with me very, very clearly. Trey, there's in here and out there. And what she meant by that was here in the House, the Capitol, we can find areas to work together. Out there, that's where you get political. You know, let me interpret that loosely. That's where you go out and you talk smack. That's where you go out and you use your talking points and you bring down you assassinate the character, blah, blah, blah. I get that. And again, in the book, I really try and just say it how it is. Here's what happens. Here's how you work on bringing down the opposition. But what Debbie Wasserman Schultz was getting at and what I really believed in is that when you get under that dome, that there are areas that Democrats and Republicans can work together.
I worried that you were a little tone deaf in that part of the book because don't you remember that we don't know the in there part. We just know the out there part. So there you are, Wasserman Schultz saying, yeah, we got it. We know that that's how the game is played. But the consumers on the outside don't. You know, we just hear the public pronouncements, the character assassinations.
Yep.
That's why we all fall out of love with our politicians.
Absolutely.
And you were trying to bridge the divide, but you weren't critical of that sort of conceit. You didn't say this is terrible and we have to stop ripping each other in public to Wasserman Schultz at that time. You sort of accepted that that's the way the game is played.
I get it. And as I say, there's politics in politics, and it's been going on since the dawn of our democracy, since America's been founded. It's been happening in Europe even long before our country was around. This will always be there. There will always be the for, the against, the opposition. What's going to be interesting to see is I think that in this country, most recently, the political pendulum we've seen swing pretty rapidly and pretty extremely. You look at George W. Bush all the way over to Barack Obama, Barack Obama to Donald Trump. These are pretty extensive swings. But unfortunately, I think that the talk out there has been vile. It's been disgusting. I look at people who call themselves Republicans and the way that they treated Barack Obama, and it makes me sick to my stomach. At the same time, I see Kathy Griffin beheading President Trump. All of this stuff is nonsensical. I get it. But there's got to be a point in life where I think that I personally am just like, look, if you can understand that it's there and begin to get over it, you will not have a heart attack when you watch
it. I know
politics.
That, but really, that was the takeaway for me from that passage. I was a little disappointed in your take on it, but I thought, okay, this guy's on the end, and he's trying to play the game fair and square, and his message is to us is to look past that, look past the fireworks.
But I would also say, though, that when you look past it, you can find areas where people do work together. One of the things that I, and then eventually other Republicans even came on board with, that I worked with Democrats, was on things like criminal justice reform and infrastructure. By the way, things like infrastructure are terribly boring. Okay, you're not gonna. Why would the TV news cover that when they can have pugs dressed as human beings?
Hold on. Okay. Stop right there. I'm going to pause. Trey Radel's in our studio. His book is Democracy. It's the true story of weird politics, money, madness, finger food. It's his journey through the recent Congress. We'll pause here. President Trump is about to take some questions. We'll join that live. Will you join us afterwards?
I would love to.
Absolutely. This is your old career. It's 151 on WGN. This is John Williams. Democracy is the book written by Trey Radel, the former congressman from Florida. He's a Republican, and yet he's kind of young and fun. It's a true story of weird politics, money, madness, and finger food. You're not a libertarian. You're a progressive or libertarian? Libertarian.
I'm libertarian. I'm a Republican, and I remain that way today, even though I have some very serious differences with the Republican Party, especially on social issues. But when it comes to fiscal issues, I, quite frankly, I'm an equal opportunity shot taker. I think that both parties have lost their minds in many degrees, that they fight each other just to fight. But at the end of the day, I'm a libertarian-leaning Republican.
President Trump is speaking now with the president of Romania at a sort of coordinated event. You know how those are, the shared podiums, the interpreters. Then afterwards, they'll take a couple questions. You can imagine what the questions will be for the president. Kim Gordon in the newsroom will join us to that sort of Q&A with the president when it happens. Kim, it's not happening just yet.
No, he's right now talking about Qatar and the
Saudi Arabia,
that whole pact, and talking about the fact that Qatar has historically been a funder of terrorism, and he's calling on them to stop it. So that's what he's speaking about now, and then we're also waiting for the president of Romania to speak, so it could be a few more minutes.
Okay, keep us posted. That might happen during your news, maybe a little bit after. And we haven't even told the story of the sheep shearing subsidies, which, again, you should buy this book, Democracy, just because of that story. It runs through your book, but it's just perfect. Let's do this. Let's visit for another minute or so here. We'll do the news at the top of the hour. We'll take the president when he decides to answer questions. And then I want you to just kind of walk me through the sheep shearing episode, because it's a big part of your book. But you were about to say something about why infrastructure legislation is boring.
Yeah. So we were talking about what happens in Washington, D.C., what happens outside when people go and campaign. And, of course, they destroy each other. The job of a campaign is to assassinate the character of the person you're running against. It is an unfortunate part of our politics. It's covered the most because it's the most sensational, and it's what we chat about on talk radio, what the TV does. But there are things that are being done inside the United States Congress where Democrats and Republicans do share some common ground and have commonality. I do believe that tax reform may be one of the things that we're on the cusp of, especially when it comes to corporate tax rates in the United States. But there's things like infrastructure, WERDA. Has anybody ever heard of a WERDA? You always have these dumb things. WRRRDA. Water Resources and Redevelopment Act. Who's going to talk about that when you've got, you know, people destroying each other on Twitter in 140 characters? That was one of the things that was passed that I worked on in transportation and infrastructure, my committee. We passed on the House floor with, I think, just one dissenting vote. Criminal justice reform is another area where Democrats and Republicans are working to fight against, in part, the war on drugs in particular, because you have so many nonviolent offenders in the United States who are locked up away from their families. They can't be productive members of society. Criminal justice reform, one of the things that, again, Republicans and Democrats are working on, is to get rid of minimum mandatory minimums. And so these are some areas that are not really talked about a whole lot, but they do exist.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Trey Radel is in our studio. That's spelled R-A-D-E-L. It's pronounced like dreidel, dreidel, dreidel.
You know, I made you out of clay.
Trey Radel. It works for me. It's a 157. We'll do the news in a minute. We'll join the president, and then I want you to tell us the most fascinating sheep shearing story you've ever heard.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Here we go.
Here's John Williams.
Actually, I don't have to think big thoughts.
Hey, John, we are getting ready to go right now to the White House. President Trump just now starting to take questions.
Come on, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. President. Apologies.
That's all right, Dave.
Mr. President, this morning on Twitter, you were referring to the testimony of James Comey vindicating you. But I wondered if you could tell us in person, sir, why you feel that his testimony vindicated you when it's really boils down to his word against your word. And if you could also tell us, sir, do tapes exist of your conversations with him?
Well, I'll tell you about that maybe sometime in the very near future. But in the meantime, no collusion, no obstruction. He's a leaker. But we want to get back to running our great country. Jobs, trade deficits, we want them to disappear fast. North Korea, big problem. Middle East, a big problem. So that's what I am focused on. That's what I have been focused on. But yesterday showed no collusion, no obstruction. We are doing really well. That was an excuse by the Democrats who lost an election that some people think they shouldn't have lost, because it's almost impossible for the Democrats to lose the Electoral College, as you know. You have to run up the whole East Coast, and you have to win everything as a Republican, and that's just what we did. So it was just an excuse. But we were very, very happy. And frankly, James Comey confirmed a lot of what I said, and some of the things that he said just weren't true. Thank you very much. Do you have a question?
Thank you. And, Mr. President, if you could tell us, a couple weeks ago, President Trump was in Brussels at the NATO meeting, and not only was he encouraging NATO members to pay up the 2% required of GDP for national defense, but he also was saying that countries, including yours, who had not paid 2% in the past, should make up for that difference. Do you think that's fair?
This would be the president of Romania responding.
And I met President Trump, and I listened to his speech, and I liked it. Because, you see, NATO is based on values, but it is ultimately a military alliance. And, you know, military spendings are complicated, and you need a lot of money. Because NATO is the strongest alliance the Earth ever saw, and we want to keep it that way. So we have to spend money for defense purposes. And spending money means if you're in alliance, everybody has to spend money. This is called burden sharing. And I fully agree, Mr. President, to that. So, of course, some people liked this better and some didn't like it so much, but it's a simple fact that we have to do this, not as a purpose in itself. We have to do this to stay strong, to be strong, and to defend our nations.
100% correct. And, you know, one of the things I was referring to during that speech was the fact that, yes, they haven't paid what they should be paying now, but for many years they haven't been paying. So I said, do we ever go back and say, how about paying the money from many, many years past? Now, I know no president has ever asked that question, but I do. We're going to make NATO very strong. You need the money to make it strong. You can't just do what we've been doing in the past. So I did say, yes, you haven't paid this year, but what about the past years, the many past years where you haven't paid? Perhaps you should pay some or all of that money back. You have a question?
Domnișoara Avramescu, TVR.
Thank you. I have a question for President Trump. On the matter of security, sir, you many of the countries on the eastern flank of NATO, including Romania, see Russia as a threat to the security and the peace in the region. Do you share this vision, and do you think that the United States should act under Article 5 if any of this country will be under military aggression? Thank you very much.
Well, I'm committing the United States and have committed, but I'm committing the United States to Article 5. And certainly we are there to protect. And that's one of the reasons that I want people to make sure we have a very, very strong force by paying the kind of money necessary to have that force. But yes, absolutely, I'd be committed to Article 5.
Thank you. Mr. President, were there any discussion about the visa waiver program for Romania? Is there a time frame for including our country in this program? Thank you.
We didn't discuss it. We didn't discuss it, but there would be certainly, it would be something we will discuss, Mr. President.
I mentioned this issue, and I also mentioned it during other meetings I had, because this is important for us. It's important for Romanians who want to come to the United States. And you see, more and more people come, President Trump, from Romania to the United States. Some come as tourists, some come for business, and those who come for business should be encouraged. So the matter of visa waiver would be probably important to discuss, and we all hope that we will advance on this.
Good. Oh, I look at those hands up there, President. Do you have this in Romania, too? I don't know.
Yeah. I got the microphone.
Oh, boy.
If you allow me,
If I could only sell that, if I could only sell it. Who would like to ask? Should I take one of the killer networks that treat me so badly as fake news? Should I do that? Huh? Go ahead, John. Be fair, John.
Oh, absolutely.
Remember how nice you used to be before I ran? Such a nice man.
Always fair. Mr. President, I want to get back to James Comey's testimony. You suggested he didn't tell the truth in everything he said. He did say under oath that you told him to let the Flynn, you said you hoped the Flynn investigation you could let
he could I didn't let go. Say that.
So he lied about that.
Well, I didn't say that. I mean, I will tell you, I didn't say that.
And did he ask you to pledge his
And there'd be nothing wrong if I did say it, according to everybody that I've read today, but I did not say that.
And did he ask for a pledge of loyalty from you? That's another thing he said.
No, he did not.
So he said those things under oath. Would you be willing to speak under oath to give your version of those events?
100%. I didn't say under oath. I hardly know the man. I'm not going to say, I want you to pledge allegiance. Who would do that? Who would ask a man to pledge allegiance under oath? I mean, think of it. I hardly know the man. It doesn't make sense. No, I didn't say that, and I didn't say the other.
So if Robert Mueller wanted to speak with you about that,
I would be glad to tell him exactly what I just told you, John.
And you seem to be hinting that there are recordings of those conversations.
I'm not hinting anything. I'll tell you about it over a very short period of time.
When is that?
Okay. Okay. Do you have a question here?
When will you tell us about the recordings?
Over a fairly short period of time.
Tomorrow now? Are there tapes, sir?
Oh, you're going to be very disappointed when you hear the answer. Don't worry. John, do you have a question for the president?
Yes. Thank you. And President Yohannes, you are no stranger to Russian aggression. Vladimir Putin recently suggested that Romania could be in Russia's crosshairs. How concerned should the world be about Russian aggression in your region? And how concerned should we be here in the United States about what Russia tried to do in our election, sir?
Everybody's concerned. But you see, being concerned should lead you to being prepared. So in my opinion, we have to be very clear, very simple, and very straightforward if we talk about Russia and with Russia. In my opinion, we need dialogue. But on the other hand, we need what we all together decided in NATO, a strong deterrence. So this combination, strong deterrence and dialogue, should lead towards a solution which is feasible for every part. Domnul Pantazi.
Hello, Mr. President Trump. You mentioned earlier the anti-corruption fight in Romania. It is a matter of high importance in our country. But we see now that the anti-corruption fight and the efforts to consolidate the rule of law are sometimes undermined by some politicians, part of what we can call the Bucharest swamp. Is your administration going to support the anti-corruption fight in Romania, and how can you do it? Thank you.
Well, we support very strongly Romania, and therefore, obviously, we do support that fight on anti-corruption. We will always support that. And we support your president. We think he's done an outstanding job. Very popular, very solid, working very hard. We know everything that's going on. And, yeah, and he's going to win that fight. He's going to win that battle, but he has our support.
As a problem for the U.S.-Romania partnership and for the American investor.
John, we've been listening to live coverage of President Trump taking questions after his visit with the president of Romania this afternoon. He only took a few questions, really, about the whole Comey thing, mainly talking about Qatar and asking Qatar to stop funding terrorists. But a few questions here and there, a few fireworks about the Comey testimony, but otherwise kind of... would you say maybe trying to avoid it a little bit?
Maybe so, but or delay it a little bit. I mean, right. What I heard him say was, does he have tapes? He said, I'm going to say soon. He wouldn't be any clearer than that. He said, my answer will disappoint you. You can read into that what you want, but I'm going to guess he's going to say soon that he does not have any tape recordings. That would be disappointing to the media. And then about whether or not he would testify before Robert Mueller, would he actually under oath say the things that he just said to the reporter? He said, absolutely, I will. I don't know if Mueller is listening, but rather than his attorney, would the president actually testify under oath that Comey lied before the Congress is an interesting scenario. I'm curious to hear how that's now going to play out. So that's the latest on that from my end, Kim. Continue to monitor the president.
It actually just wrapped up. They just walked back inside the White House, so they're done.
Okay, good. Oh, and by the way, and if you just joined us, the Democrats lost the election, the Electoral College. They don't know how to run an election. You got to run it up the Eastern Seaboard. And he went huge in the Electoral College, which is earlier in the president's statements. Okay, so actually an analyst, it just happens to be in our studio, a recent member of Congress named Trey Radel, who is not only a past member of the media, but also a past member of the Congress. He served from 14 to 16 or 12 to 14? 13 to 15, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, okay, his book is out. It's called Democracy. We were talking to him about that. Give me your thoughts on this, Mr. Congressman, in a minute. The book is called Democracy, and it's written by a guy named Trey Radel, former congressman, a conservative who made a name for himself as, some people said, a Tea Party member, but you say I wasn't a Tea Party
Never
member.
Use
that
those words.
Label was attached to you and it stuck maybe unfairly. So you served a term and you've now written a book about your crazy romp through one term in the U.S. Congress. Your comments about what President Trump just said.
There you go. Yeah. No, look, I mean, the fact that he keeps going back to the election is so insane to me. That there's got to be a point. I don't want to sound cliche, but there's got to be a point where we demand more from our president to sound more presidential. Words matter. They matter with the way that I believe that media has gotten the short end of the stick. I am a Republican. I will say even that I do believe that very generally speaking, Republicans get harsher treatment than Democrats in most of the mainstream media. Still, I'm a journalist. It's what I've done all of my adult life. And the way that we have this atmosphere today, that journalists are the evil ones, that they're the ones who are more partisan than anybody else, and that people trust somebody like a Julian Assange more than they do our national newspapers and media figures, to me is sad, and I would even say frightening.
Why do you say frightening?
Because At what point, look, we already know that, as we talked about a little bit earlier in this program, we talked about politics and politics. Within that, you have misinformation, disinformation, these things go on. But at what point do we all just throw our hands up and say, nothing matters? Nothing is trustworthy. I don't know. I hope that in some ways, just like the political pendulum swings in this country, that maybe at some point the sort of cultural pendulum of I hate all media, and from sometimes both sides, can at least kind of come back, reel it in a little bit to where we can have figures in society that we don't just automatically look at as the enemy.
One last thing, and it's something I've just been kidding about and alluding to, and now we'll finally get to. You tell the story about you trying to pass a bill that would end sheep shearing subsidies in the Congress. It's $50 million that's allocated for that. You discover this. Your staff says, hey, you want a bill to put your name on? Let's get started being a congressman. Here's a bill. It's about sheep shearing. There's a $50 million subsidy. Government can't afford that. And it won't affect really anybody in Florida, so it's kind of a safe thing for you to do.
Yep.
So what happens?
So we knew as a freshman office that I'm not going to step in and tackle immigration reform or tax reform. We found something that aligned with my principles as a fiscal conservative. Again, social issues very different. I differ a lot from Republicans. That said, $50 million appropriated to teach people to shear sheep. This is something that's been done since Moses in the Bible, okay? Shearing sheep, $50 million. This came at a time that the United States Congress, as it often does, was fighting over things like food stamps for children. And so we find this, and I'm like, well, look, I'll get the support of Democratic and Republican leadership on this. This is clearly a handout. In it, they did everything from teach people to shear sheep. They bought sheep shearers. They flew people to New Zealand to go learn how to market lamb. Really what we're talking about here in terms of the equipment is costs for startup. You're a startup business. Why did this group get this? So in the story, I explain how this is a microcosm of everything that we hate about Washington, D.C. And this example, sheep shearing, can be applied to multiple different examples. But I tell the story about going onto the House floor and thinking, hey, I'm going to be with a Republican and we're going to argue against the Democrat. You know, those Democrats, they're always wanting to put us in debt and spend more money. I go onto the House floor and I'm like with my fellow Republican, like, yeah, buddy, let's do this. We're gonna get this on here. We're going to chop this $50 million off. We're going to pop bottles of champagne, baby. Let's do it. The Republican argued against me. You know, Republicans, the fiscal conservative, you know, be responsible with tax dollars party. I had to fight against Republican leadership and Democratic leadership at a time when we're arguing with, at that time, $17 trillion debt. You've got representatives from here in Chicago fighting for welfare for people who genuinely deserve it in this city. And we're arguing over giving money to teach people to shear sheep. I fought leadership on both sides of the aisle.
Wait, what was their problem with, how did they defend it?
Oh, it's ridiculous. Well, we have to have this. They said the guy I'm fighting against, by the way, is Texas. Colin Peterson out of Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
And Texas was the Republican.
Yeah.
The Minnesota guy who had been in the United States Congress since he'd been in politics since I was born, 1976.
Yeah. Right.
He'd been in politics since the 1990s when I'm going to school here. I fight against them. Their justification, well, you know, some of our overregulations really destroyed the sheep and lamb industry, and so this is a way to really help them out. Like, what? So you have screwed up one problem so bad in this country that now you want to give handouts to make it better. And quite frankly, this is, again, I think not just a microcosm of what's screwed up about Washington, but one of the things I really try and do in the book is bridge what I hope I can do is bridge Democrats and Republicans on the same page in some things. Look, there are going to be Democrats who read this and think I'm disgusting because I'm a fiscal conservative and would entertain some of the policies I did. Republicans, the same thing. Republicans have a problem that I have issued. Like, I'd never understood why Republicans are constantly calling for small government, but when it comes to marriage, they want the government in your bedroom.
Yeah, right.
I don't get these things, but what I hope is that at the end of the day with the book, you get to, I don't get very judgy in it. I don't condemn or support. I just kind of say it how it is. But at the end of the day, what I take away with that book is that the Congress is filled with really good men and women on both sides of the aisle. But what our country has been at battle with since our existence is how much government and how little government do we need? And I think ultimately it lies in the context of time.
Friend of mine, when we were recording the Mincing Rascals podcast, which we broadcast on Saturdays here, asked the question, how did you feel the Senate comported itself at the Comey hearings yesterday? And all four of us in this little panel today, you can hear it later on today at WGNradio.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast will broadcast part of it Saturday at 11 a.m. Every single person said, I was proud of the institution of the United States Senate. I thought the both sides asked good questions. They cared. They listened. It was civil. It wasn't nitpicky. It was partisan a little bit. But sure. At the end of the day, you had the idea that they were seeking the truth. And I felt really good about the institution of our government in that sense. Isn't that nice to know?
The institution, I'm telling you, as broken as it may seem in today's hyper-partisan society, and the fact that we can look at our telephone and get news shoved down our throat every second of the day with some of the worst hack talking points or partisan, destruction of each other's character, I really can't stress enough that I befriended hardcore liberal Democrats. And there are relationships in Congress, and both parties are filled with good people. The institution can and will survive.
So is it your estimation then that, in fact, it's better on a personal level, member of Congress to member of Congress, than we would think?
Absolutely.
From the outside?
I thought that people I'd be get shanked in the hallways of the Capitol. If you're a Republican, watch MSNBC. If Democrat, watch Fox. You'd think you'd get shanked walking through the Capitol. I didn't bleed. I wasn't shanked.
You lived to tell the tale. It's called democracy. By the way, you're here for Lit Fest.
Chicago Lit Fest, Sunday, 2 p.m. with Kristen McQuarrie of the Chicago Tribune.
Think about that. She's on the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Nice.
And she's dynamite. She's one of the editorial writers for the Chicago Tribune. So
Sunday at 2 p.m. Chicago Lit Fest, Printers Row. I'd love to see you there. Let's hang out, Democrat or Republican.
It's 2:30. Thanks, Trey. Well,
thank
done.
You. This is a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
It's a terrific book. It's 2:30. The news is next on GN.
There's no fuzz on that. Come on, Violetta, try it. There's no fuzz on that.
There's no fuzz on that. But I think that there is messing it up. Just no fuzz on that.
Can't do it again. So the Warriors are in Cleveland for the fourth and final game of the NBA Finals.
No fuzz on that.
Yeah.
You know what? I think you're right.
Yeah.
This is sort of like the scene in Facebook or The Facebook. Remember the movie? And he goes, it's cleaner. Take the out. Facebook.
Ah! Less is more.
Standing outside our showcase studio is one. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Mr. Thomas, I presume?
Not this time of year.
What is your occupation, sir?
I am the faculty advisor of WLTL Radio at Lyons Township High School.
Where my son went to school and learned under your tutelage all of the great things about broadcasting. Griffin is now my Saturday producer. My Monday through Friday producer is one Elif Garris. How do you know Elif?
Elif was also one of my students at WLTL.
You guys are like a state power in radio and broadcasting, aren't you?
We try. We finished second in the nation this year. So
I was just going to say, actually, I'm not kidding. I happen to know that you guys compete in the national radio competition and do well every year. I think you guys may have won the year Griffin or Elif were there.
I think we did, yeah. We won six times in 13 years.
I don't know that the Chicagoland area appreciates that. There's an annual national competition for broadcasting, and every year LT is there. Lyons Township High School, WLTL, the radio station, has won 6 out of 13 times?
6 out of 13 times.
Nicely done, sir. Who are you with today?
I got my in-laws from Wisconsin and my own kids down here. We're playing tourist in the own city here, so.
Isn't that a great city to do it in?
And a beautiful day, too.
You're heading out to Navy Pier, huh?
We're going down to Navy Pier, yep.
All right, say something in broadcasting. Why don't you sign off for us here?
Sign off? Well, your show's still going.
just say something in radio.
I'll say we love listening to Radio 720 WGN.
Oh, that's good. That's good. No fuss on that. All right. Nice to see you, Mr. Thomas.
Take it easy. Bye, Elif.
Bye.
Yeah, by the way, Elif, yeah, you should say hello to him, too. He's your former teacher. How did I do on that one, Violetta?
That Kim? Was good.
Kim, didn't you feel it? That was kind of organic.
I felt it all the way up here, seven floors up. It was rocking and rolling up here.
No fuss on that. Yeah, you're going to have to. That's already old, isn't it? I've already ruined it. It's 2:42. It's time for The Bright Side. We do this on Fridays at this time. You call in, tell us something good in your world. That's your bright side. If you can't think of one, your assignment is to, right now, cogitate on that and tell me something big or small that's making you smile. Here we go now.
Some things in life are bad.
Call me right now.
They can really make you mad.
It's Friday, after all.
Other things just make you swear and curse.
My number's 312.
When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle.
981.
And this'll help things turn out for the best.
7200. You can text to that number.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Okay, the phone lines are open. Call right now. This bit works, but you have to call. 312-981-7200. Tell me something good in your world. Kim Gordon in the WGN Radio Newsroom. What's your bright side?
1 year from today, my son is getting married.
Oh, nice! Nice! You and I have to trade notes. I know you were kind of talking about that the other day, but...
Yeah, this is my second one to get married, so I've already been down that road once.
My first does it in November, and oh,
so excited.
Violetta Podramatic, what's your bright side?
Well, I love to patio life. Wonderful weather coming up this weekend, and my patio furniture is being delivered.
Woohoo! I was at my condo today. We're getting the floors redone, and the floors have been completely sanded, and they put a paintbrush of the new lacquer on there, and the floor just went pow. It just came to life. It looked great, and I thought, I can see the future of our floors. And it made me feel really good. It's going to cost me about $10,000, but it made me feel good.
And the smell might make you sick for a little while.
Actually, I kind of liked it. I wanted to hang around a little while, but that's not a good
idea. Smells like a magic marker.
I know it does.
Always look on the light side of life.
All right, Evelyn called first. Thanks for calling, Evelyn. What's your bright side?
Well, I'm up at Lake Carroll with all of my cruise friends that we met on our very first cruise with you.
Evelyn. I didn't know that was going to be you. It was such a nice picture. Our friend Sue sent me a picture of you all. Brendan, I wanted to be there this weekend. Life is too complicated. We can't right now. So
there's no fuzz on that.
I love you, Evelyn. My best to Henry.
Okay, bye.
There's some good people up there. We met him on a cruise with Kelly Cruises. I'm going on another one. I'll tell you more about that tomorrow on my Saturday show. Go to kellycruises.com if you want to find out more. Let's go to Debbie. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Hi, John. My oldest son is marrying a wonderful girl tomorrow.
Oh, and you're going to have great weather, too. Thank you, Debbie. Congrats. This is Scott. What's your bright side, Scott? You're on the air.
Well, John, like you, I was in Minneapolis away from my family, and now I'm back home with my family. So
feels good, doesn't it?
Yep.
I'm glad you called. Thanks, Scott. I got another Scott online. I think it's 5. Hey, Scott, this is John. What's your bright side?
Hi, John. I'm on my way back from Cleveland, and I'm thinking about the fact that the Cubs are still World Series champions, and I was there at Game 7. That's got me smiling from ear to ear. That's the thing.
A lot of us are still borrowing from that. Thank you, Scott. Well put. Hey, Krista, this is John. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
John, I'm a teacher, and I am...
You just cut out. She told Elif, I'm a teacher, and I'm out on summer break. I almost always get that call from teachers. Thank you, Krista. This is Dan. You're on WGN. Why are you smiling today, Dan? Hey, Dan. Breaker, Dan. Dan is having trouble getting through. He told Elif off the air, my daughter-in-law is about to give birth at any moment. Maybe he was called away. Thank you for sharing that. Our best to them. How about Sherry on line 8? Why are you smiling, Sherry?
Hi, John. I'm smiling because this weekend we are celebrating my parents' 50th anniversary.
How about that? There's something you forgot. Happy anniversary, 5-0. That's a big one. Well done. Hey, David, this is John. Why are you smiling at your place today?
John, we're smiling big because my son, David, just got accepted into medical school.
Oh, wow. What an accomplishment, huh?
Fantastic. Yeah, we're very happy and proud of him.
Where's he going to go?
He's going to Chicago Medical School at Roslyn University.
So he'll be nearby, too.
Yes, sir.
Everybody
yes, sir.
Wins. Thank you, David.
Thank you. For life
is quite absurd, and death's the final word. Hey, Jody, this is John. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Hi, John. I'm calling from Bradenton, Florida. My husband and I moved away 4 years ago. We still listen, and we're so happy you're back on the radio.
What a nice thing to say. I am, too. Thank you. Hey, Bridget, this is John. What's your bright side?
After having all three of my kids in college this last year, I finally got one graduated, and all three of them are home with me this summer. Everybody home under the same roof again.
Isn't that fun?
I love it.
Here's a prediction, though. You're going to call in August and say, John, I'm so glad they've all left.
Oh, I hope not.
Shame on me. That's your bright side. And what am I doing, raining on it? That's not how this works. Hey, Chris, it's John. You're on WGN on line 12. What's your bright side?
My bright side is, after 33 years, I retired as a teacher last week.
Oh, no kidding. So how is it? Is retirement everything you thought it would be?
So far, so good. I'm just out of my wife's way now.
Yeah, that's your new job, is to stay out of the way, right?
That's right. For life is
quite absurd and death. Hey, Harvey, this is John. You're on WGN. What's your bright side, Harv?
Hi, John. My wife retired after 34 years, and she's extremely happy, which makes me happy, and we're going on 51 years of marriage.
Hi, boy, Harvey. My best to you both. Thank you. And then sometimes bright sides come in this form. Hey, Julie, this is John. Why are you smiling today?
Oh, I'm smiling because I just got off work and I found gas at $2.25 a gallon. I'm a happy girl.
Let's go to Sally. Hey, Sally, it's John. Why are you smiling?
I am so happy because my daughter, Mindy, had an aneurysm and a stroke March 6th, but now she is deficiency clear. She is perfect. She's back at work as an OBGYN.
Oh, no kidding. And she's in the medical profession, too, huh?
She's a nurse, yes.
Holy cow. Whew!
She's very lucky. She's very, very lucky.
Sally, thanks for the call. That's great news. Hey, Dorothy, it's John. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Hi. My granddaughter received a gold medal through Scholastic Awards yesterday at Carnegie Hall in New York. You
must always. Are you kidding me? Wow.
Yes. No, I'm not kidding you.
Well, I know, but that's an expression, Dorothy. Don't take it literally. Thank you for the call. And finally, let's go with Kevin on line 9. Hey, Kevin, it's John. What's your bright side? Hi.
John.
Yeah.
My wife came home last night with a tattoo on her arm. She came back from tattoo parlor with my daughter, and it's got my name on it. But she always calls me Fuzzy Bunny. Now she's got Fuzzy Bunny on her arm, but I'm happy and bright about that.
You know, John, there's no fuzz on that. If life seems jolly rotten,
there's something you forgot. Look at that. Violetta just dropping it in. Just making it happen. Thank you for the call. That's the bright side. We do it Fridays from about 2:40 to about 2:50. About this time. Where are you going to be next Friday? Tell your friends to listen to WGN. Rokan's in the studio. Anna DeVlantis, too. Another show ready for you.
Yes, it is. It's been prepared by the chefs back there, and we're going to serve it.
It would appear as though some of it is still being created backstage.
Yes,
right now.
Yes, we had a little communications. We've literally lost one of our contributors. We just don't know what happened to her, but we think we can find her.
Right.
We're very hopeful about
that. What are
you
going to do today?
We'll play a little bit of the press conference from about an hour ago,
mm-hmm.
with analysis.
By the way,
whining.
Trump won the Electoral College. I don't know if you guys have picked up on that.
That was mentioned today, just for those who had not recalled that.
Do you get the feeling
you know how hard it is for Republicans to win the Electoral College?
Really? Was it hard in 2000 for a Republican to win the Electoral College? And 2004 for a Republican to win the Electoral College? I mean, what is he talking about?
I don't know why he didn't mention that it was a landslide electoral win, too. I mean, that's... If you're going to go there, you just do it right. Make it a big one, too.
Oh, he's good with the Whopper. He's very good. By the way, I prefer the Big Mac, but that's a separate issue.
He's a Filet-O-Fish guy, actually, for the record.
Oh, he is?
He is. On Fridays, he and Jared will often be seen with the Filet-O-Fish.
Oh, that's very good.
You're just making that up,
I'm not.
Right? Are
no,
you kidding
there
me?
There was a reporter who was on, you know, was flying with him, Air Force One, and says that they had a conversation about that.
I saw a picture once of him on Air Force One with a McDonald's bag, and I don't know. That seemed to be beneath the dignity of Air Force One. I don't want a McDonald's bag on my Air Force One.
Beneath the dignity. We've got a list.
Really?
We've got a long, long list on that.
I'm
that
pretty
particular.
Sure there's a chef on board, too.
I know. They've got a chef. You don't need a Big Mac or a filet of
fish. I do.
Remember when, no, but remember when Barack Obama and Joe Biden went to Five Guys?
Yes.
Like, it was like almost like this time. And
it kind of works, though, doesn't
it? Yeah, they're formal. They're like, hey, Joe, let's go over to Five Guys, you know? It was like a
was that
weird.
One of the ones where then they're both hitting the back seat of their pants, going, "Now, do you got the money, or who's got my credit card?"
Turns out the Five Guys were fairly large donors to them in 2008. That may have been why that happened. All right, thank you very much, John.